Rock and or Roll, part of the Pantheon Network. And on today's episode, you will hear Dave Swanson tell the story of his band The Pop, which he originally formed in Los Angeles in the early 70s with his partner Roger Prescott. The Pop were around when Van Halen first started, and they sort of rode that wave from glam, hard rock, to new wave power pop. First, we will hear Dave talk about writing one of my favorite power pop songs, the song we're hearing now called Shake Away, from the 1979 album by The Pop called Go. And then Dave will tell the story of The Pop, from his beginnings in Chicago to the end of the band in the early 80s.
One of my favorites is Shake Away. Can you talk about putting that song together? I really love that song.
Yeah, thank you. It was a very quick song. It was one of those things where I was sitting around. We had just gotten signed, I think, to Arista. It was right at the beginning of, end of 78, mm-hmm. into 79, probably right after the holidays. We were casting about for producers at that point, and I was spending a lot of time, of course, trying to write. In my mind, it had a kind of an apocalyptic meaning or a implication, if you will, of an end times, some sort of Freudian death consciousness or something, you know, where it doesn't come across that way, but I was thinking you wake up with this kind of sense of excited, anxious foreboding about the greater condition of humanity. Woke up this morning with a rattle in my brain, gotta get gone lest I remain. You're just kind of filling up some space there, you're trying to outrun that feeling and not remain in this foreboding thing, but having a conscious sense of imminent peril, if you will, devolution of the condition of the world, right? And if the thought catches up to you, and just trying to shake it off, basically, shake off that has become, I don't know, I think for many young people today, I mean, I'm talking, the people who are in their 20s, 30, early 30s, 20s to 30, I think they're much more despondent than we were at that age back then. Mm-hmm. I think the world is a darker place for them. I think there's less hope for them now than there may have been for us. I'm not sure about that. It's all relative, I suppose. But as I look over the course of, my 7 decades now of my life, and a lot of it is just nostalgia, I suppose. But I do feel that the music was better when I was a kid, than it is now. That's debatable, I know, but that things just in general were simpler, easier, more direct, more somehow integrated, and hence more supportive in some sort of cultural way. In that sense of cultural integration, I think we're much more isolated now and so forth. But even at that stage, when I signed to Arista, that 1978-79 space there, I would have these senses of impending doom or something, especially just smoking a lot of grass or something like that, drinking too much and smoking dope. You get a little depressive, a little maudlin. So it was like that, and the whole idea was just to shake it off, get up, get into gear, run around, have some fun, stick my head out, take a look around, hear all the sights and see all the sounds, let's shake away, that kind of thing. So that's what it meant to me, and it just came out very quickly. We'll be right back. Yeah, I used to play in Madison when I was still living in Chicago. Before I went to L.A., they had a power trio at the time called Shaky Jake. I was the bass player, and we did covers of The Who and a lot of Humble Pie and, I don't know, some Johnny Winter and that sort of thing, you know. Yeah, so where would you like to start? I mean, that's kind of a jumping off point for me in terms of my personal history in L.A. Yeah, I went there in the beginning, early May, not the beginning, but May of 72, left Shaky Jake there and went out to L.A. with a plan of sort of writing these retro pop-ish, think 72. I was thinking, you know, I actually had this thing, you know, this concept in my head, you know, slightly retro, like some kind of like Johnny Angel and the Flying Tigers, 56 Cadillac, strange sort of hybrid glitter smash, cusp, you know, the glitter smashers had occurred, okay, from England, Slade, T-Rex, some of those guys, you know, were, and Stewart too, of course, with Faces, and now, with the Every Picture Tells a Story tours that came through Chicago just the year before. So there was kind of this glitterish thing going on that I wanted to kind of carry in with a kind of a retro cast thing to it, moving forward with these kind of, you know, I guess the term hadn't really occurred yet, but a power pop-ish edge to or direction of the songs. I'd always written songs since I was about 15, 16. And so I already considered myself to be a songwriter. And so I was kind of trying to cobble together. I don't know, dozen and a half of these type songs, some of which were, I mean, it wasn't that well honed so that it wasn't like a cookie cutter kind of stamp to the songs, but there was that kind of influence in a few of them and just general pop, rock sort of sensibility to the rest or rock, you know? And so I went up there with this sort of concept in mind, those back in the days when concepts were starting to evolve, right?
Yeah,
We need to look no further than Bowie's advent in that same year. You know, he came with such force that it was somewhat stunning. Myself, having just gotten there, sort of with this other idea, you know, I mean, it didn't really throw me off course, but there was a natural sort of reaction. I think that, oh, well, I don't want to do that kind of thing. And yet you couldn't help but sort of be influenced by it at the same time. So so I kind of knocked around for the first few months. And, there was this place out in Hollywood called the Musicians Contact Service, which you may know about. But they had like these, you know, big three ring binders full of like drummers, guitar players, singers, bass players, keyboard players, you know, and so you'd pay your $25 or whatever, and you get to go in there and hunt through these volumes of people, of musicians, and based on their synopses of themselves and their directions and so forth, you take some numbers and call them. You know, one thing led to another. I met a couple of managers and so forth. So I knocked around for a few months trying to get a piece of band together, and not much was really happening. And one of the people I had called was Roger Prescott. And for his phone conversation was not, if not hostile, just a little standoffish, sort of acrimonious, you know, this undercurrent of, well, I don't want to do that. I've already done that. No, I'm not doing that. In terms of musical sensibilities and things. And we both had the same idea. He wanted to, you know, put a band together, and so did I. And so we didn't click that first conversation and never got together. But along about October of that year, nothing still had been going, I guess, for either of us. He called me and said, well, we talked before. Do you remember? I said, yeah, how can I forget? And And he said, anything going on with you? And I said, no, not really. And he said, well, you know, why don't we sit down and just, you know, take another, revisit this thing, you know, and just see if there's anything that we have in common. And so we did that. And, we decided, well, yeah, we did have, I mean, he was a little more blues rock oriented. He'd come from actually originally from Virginia and up via Boston, where he had met some people. He actually auditioned, I think, for Aerosmith at one point, or yes, he did. And he knew those guys in their formative stage, or their embryonic stage anyway. And he also met David Robinson, who and the Modern Lovers up in Boston, Jonathan Richman, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So Roger and I started to get together in earnest that fall of 72 and worked, and then pretty much worked around 73. We played a couple of acoustic sort of, you know, showcase type things. we were actually calling ourselves Noggin and Twin for a brief moment. And we did these sort of really weird sort of, I don't know, kind of glitter smasherish pop acoustic things, you know, with strange songs, melodic things, you know, and we would sing in harmony some of the time, and I would sing the rest of the time, you know. And it was kind of interesting and fun, and the days of platform shoes and strange attire of some form or other. Some of it, you know, a lot of mine was kind of homemade. I had a girlfriend who was sewing stuff for me, and she was actually from the Art Institute in Chicago too, and she had come out to join me in the beginning of 73, and was, you know, she was helpful in that regard of wardrobe. She was very into fashion. She had been a silkscreen artist at the Art Institute in Chicago. That's what she'd been studying. So there was some silkscreeny stuff, and you know, it's just in terms of fabrics and clothing and stuff. So it was a lot about the look and the kind of trying to consolidate a kind of an imagey thing that, you know, there was kind of this airy fairy-ness about the whole thing, especially with the influence of Bowie and the Spiders from Mars. So it was kind of a mixture. And then eventually we just said, no, we really want to get we knew this, we wanted to get a drummer and be a rock band. We didn't want to play acoustic guitars, but we were just doing that temporarily to kind of, you know, play with, you know, get used to each other's playing and homing in on what it was we wanted to do. So we had tried a couple of different drummers. That wasn't working. And finally, I think at the end of 73, the Modern Lovers had come to LA to finish their album, which they began with John Cale in the East, but then he flamed out, and Warner Brothers had put them together with Kim Fowley to finish their record. So they were in LA and on the verge of not only finishing the record, but I guess they finished the record with Kim Fowley, delivered it to Warner Brothers, and then promptly broke up. But we had seen them at the, the Whiskey or someplace, and I'd met Robinson, and then we talked and said, what are you going to do now? And I said, we really need a drummer. Why don't you come back? And because he was going to go back for the holidays. And then he didn't know what he was going to do to Boston. And he said, yeah, okay, I'll come back. So after the holidays, he did come back. And that's when we, in the spring of 74, then came up with the name Pop. It was just Pop in the beginning. And we did a logo, and Susie, the silkscreen girlfriend, did t-shirts for, you know, we did a bunch of t-shirts and stuff. It was, we had a kind of this spiraling, you know, circus type lettering that said Pop with an exclamation point. And that was our thing, right? We made signage and so forth that went along with that. And so it was kind of this power pop stuff, the term for which had not been coined yet, going into 74. And we eventually found a fellow by the name of Steve Tetch, actually, not Stephen Tetch, the jazz guy, fusion-y guy, but Steve Tetch, T-E-T-S-C-H, I think it might have been the same spelling, I'm not sure, but he just went by Steve T. And he was a second guitar player. I was playing bass, and you know, Roger and I were writing songs, all these songs, and we were going for a vocal sound as much as an instrumental sound. So we did have 3-part harmony, and it was, you know, but it was, you know, it was rock, you know, and it was like sort of, we were pushing into that mold of the reason for the name pop was we were alluding to, the pop art movement, you know, from the mid to late 60s that had just preceded, you know, us in the art world, you know, and, but, you know, alluding to the pop artness of the Who, the Kinks, and now the Sweet, just a general pop artness of the culture, of the rock and roll culture, right? Mm-hmm. So, but it was a hard sell because people thought, well, pop, are you talking about the Carpenters or, you know, like David Cassidy, who the hell are you talking about? What are you talking about? You know, what does this mean? What does this name mean? So, you know, where are you guys in this thing? And so we always had to kind of, it was an uphill battle sort of to get people to understand where we were coming from. When they saw the band, it was different. They could see it, you know, but you know, before that, you know, a song is worth a thousand words, right? We started to get a toehold. We were just playing all anything we could get, any kind of gigs we could get. We had an agent at the time. We were looking for management, and you know, David Robinson knew a bunch of people because he knew people from Warner's, and they knew some managers. And so we were talking to different people and different producers, doing some demos here and there. Playing any gigs we could get, and Roger found this agent, Mick Gamble, appropriate agent name, right?
Yeah.
And he booked, of all things, fraternity parties at SC and UCLA, USC and UCLA, among other, you know, high school sock hops and other weird things, that all of which we played. And so seasonally, you know, like in the spring and in the winter, we'd have this barrage of these fraternity sorority gigs at these universities. And, you know, they were like 4-hour, you know, drink-a-thons, you know, beer-a-thons. But they had this wonderful, at SC, they had this wonderful mixture. It was called the Green Death. And they would mix it in a plastic garbage can. Probably new. They never seemed to have much shortage of money in those places. But so they would pour in ginger ale, cheap champagne, and vodka, and dry ice, and lime sherbet to make it green, right? So it was like this deadly concoction that, you know, you drink by the tumbler full throughout the course of the evening. So there was a lot of drinking that went on in those days. Yeah. But, you know, we play these gigs, and sure enough, you get better, you know, and people start to recognize the name. Then eventually, David Robinson was still with us through somebody's recommendation. He had reached out to a fellow by the name of Alan Rindy. I think it was David who kind of made that contact, that connection. I'm not sure. He was living in West Hollywood at the time in an apartment, and he became our manager slash, at the time he was in partnership as a production company with a fellow by the name of George Tobin. George Tobin had a recording studio on Ventura Boulevard in Studio City called Studio Sound Recorders, I believe. And it was a bona fide studio. He had, you know, right on the main drag there, little east of Laurel Canyon on Ventura Boulevard. By that time, where were we? We had been back and forth. We started out living, Roger and I, up on Mulholland Drive, just at the very east end of it. That didn't last because the house was for sale. We had to move. Then David Robinson joined us. We moved into a place on Sunshine Terrace. Actually, he moved back while we were still on Mulholland, but we had to leave there quickly and found a house on Sunshine Terrace in Studio City that we all lived in for a while and recorded there. And that's where a lot of this activity emanated from, the Sunshine Terrace place. But eventually we ended up in what we call the Pop Mansion at Riverton and Ventura Boulevard. Several apartments by this time. Steve T had one of them, Roger had one of them, and Susan and I had one of them. And we stayed there for quite a while. So that was sort of, Studio City was sort of our central area there for several years. And at the time that we met Alan and then George, Robinson was still with the band, and we started recording with them. Stephen T was in the band too. We started recording there, Berserk Records approached Robinson. We've sub-licensed the Modern Lovers record from Warner's. We want to put it out. We want to get the band together, back together. And so they persuaded him to do that. They came and he liked the limousine. They came and picked him up in the discussions, I guess. But anyway, so he went off and did that. And now we're without a drummer. And just before that, I think we were playing some kind of big, high school dance or something, and Steve T and Roger had gotten into a fight. Steve T was he was really a child of privilege, you know. He was an only child, lived in Pacific Palisades, had zero sense of responsibility to much of anyone or anything, although he did like the band, so he, you know, mostly showed up. I sometimes took some cajoling and wheedling on our part. But so Roger and he had gotten in an argument on stage about something, and Roger slapped him in the face and bloodied his nose. So he had quit just shortly before Robinson swept away by the black limousines of Berserkly Records. But now it's just me and Roger again, and Alan and George. Well, the George business wasn't going very well. He had, you know, very commercial sensibilities and was only used to working with single singers, solo artist singers. And he'd worked, I can't even remember now. I think he had something to do with Gene Pitney at one point, years before. Had a couple of hits, a song called Cinnamon, Let Me In. I mean, that kind of stuff, bubblegumish. And so that wasn't going well, especially in Roger's opinion. You know, I was perhaps more flexible on that, but Roger didn't get along with George at all. So eventually Alan bought us out from George and took us over, even though they were still in association in the studio, as his sort of sole project. And we had a production deal with them. So he he bought that out and he became the curator of that, or the overseer of that, that deal. At that point, we just were working with him. So we continued recording. We got involved with a couple of different musicians at the time, a fellow I'd played with years before in Chicago, actually when I was in college, Lee Rybacek, who had moved to LA, actually became known as Lee Kicks, a good drummer, very good drummer. But, you know, not really pop material in terms of member stuff for some reason. I can't remember why. I think he just really wanted to make a living as a studio player, basically, or get with somebody who actually had a deal. Mm-hmm. But he helped us out for several tracks. And another guitar player by the name of Jamie Herndon, a Texan, a very good musician, great guitar player, tremendous slide guitar player, and some piano, fairly decent piano. And he actually wrote a song called Down on the Boulevard, which we did a version of with George Van Allen, but later rearranged and rewrote a verse for, though we never got writer credit for it, unfortunately, in the later incarnation, because George had swept up the publishing to that in the first place somehow from Jamie. And so we couldn't, and it never worked out that he would honorably say, oh, this is a different song. by title, he just retained the title, and that we never got writing credit for what became the so-called, you know, sort of legacy hit of the pop, which was Down on the Boulevard. About this time, I invited out from Chicago the guitar player from Shaky Jake, Rick Bittner, and he became our second guitar player. We found a drummer, a fellow by the name of Joel Martinez. Joel, not Joel, but Joel Martinez, a blonde-haired Mexican from Mexico City. His mother had been was German, or his and his father was Mexican, and we called him, and he sat really low and sort of like a low rider drummer. So that was kind of how we, you know, marketed him or advertised him. You know, that was his sort of claim to fame. And Rick liked to refer to him as, yeah, I like Joel. When we were auditioning drummers, yeah, I like Joel. He's a slasher. So we ended up going with him. And unfortunately, Joel had a serious problem later on, and et cetera. I'll get into that. And meanwhile, you know, our music is evolving a little bit, right? I mean, you know, we're pretty hard rock stuff. Roger started to be influenced somewhat unduly, I thought, in my estimation, by the then burgeoning Aerosmith. And, you know, I was staying kind of more the birds-ish, who-ish side of things. My ideal for sound, and to this day, and some of the late demos that I did independently of pop late in my career, were exactly what I envisioned, which is sort of a if there were an offspring, if the birds, if the early birds and the early Who had mated and had some sort of hybrid offspring, that's kind of what I, you know, wanted and went for in my music. Ultimately, the ultimate rock sound was in my brain as that, and so it always had been. That was always kind of where I wanted. I was pulling it that way. Roger was pulling a little more to the harder rock stuff, and so it was a good blend. I mean, we were somewhat foils for each other in that, and came up with stuff that was somewhere in the middle, I suppose. Although leaning this way or that way, depending on who wrote the song. Initially, we had done a fair amount of co-writing, but that diminished over time. Although being in direct association in a band, there's always that arrangemental influence of each other, and which is, you know, pretty tantamount to co-writing, you know, if not exactly such.
Yeah.
So that's the way that was playing out, but not yet. We were still sort of co-writing and certainly co-involved in driving the band forward. So we had now had Rick Bittner from Shaky Jake and Joel Martinez on drums. And Alan was a producer / manager at that point. He was really in our corner. He was terrific. I mean, really, I can say nothing. I mean, okay, he had corny ideas and you had to take them with a grain of salt, but he always had ideas and he was always there to back us up and help us out when, you know, if a guitar got stolen or an amp blew up or something like that, he was there. He got us into some meaningful situations later. The primary one, the pivotal one being now, was an event that let me back up just a hair here. And this was the early spring of 76. By this time, we had put out one record, Backdoor Man, a fanzine from Backdoor Man magazine, a fanzine from the South Bay area, like Long Beach down around there somewhere, Redondo. A group of people had gotten behind us and were in our corner, and they would write these articles about us in their fanzine. They'd come to our shows. And ultimately, there was Don Waller, Greg Turner, Dee Dee Fay, Tom Gardner. I don't know if I got them all, but those were the four main ones of the group. And of these, they were just fans. They were wild. They were rock and roll. They loved a band called The Dogs, who had come out from Detroit, Lauren Molinaire, Mary, and Ron Wood was actually his name. Mary, I can't remember her last name now, damn it. But Lauren was the leader of the band. They were a power trio out of Detroit. The Motels had shown up at the same time, come down from San Francisco, the Bay Area. Martha Davis. And at this time, we had all met up, the three bands, along with a few other incidental ones that I can't remember any of. There was a call put out in the LA Times by the Park Service, by the Municipal Park Service guy, director, to have concerts in the parks around Los Angeles, a few places. like I think there was one out in the Valley of Cedar or someplace, you know, not Deep Valley, but along West Ventura Boulevard, out that direction, Van Nuys. Griffith Park, of course, was a big place. And I can't remember if there was, the one over in down by Hillcrest Country Club in Beverly Hills. I can't remember what it's called. Beverly Hills Park, somewhere over there. And those are the three places that we played and at these summer concerts. So we met out in North Hollywood at some civic building with this park director, you know, running this thing. And we all showed up, and that's how we met the Dogs and the Motels. And sure enough, we did these gigs. They would provide the PAs, and it would be a Sunday afternoon event, you know? And so There were several of these in the early part of 76, spring, really, early spring, because, you know, it's always summer there, pretty much, you know, if it's not raining. And over the course of, I don't know, just a couple of months, the idea came about, and I think Alan, was primarily us, you know, myself and Roger and Alan, said, you know, we need to do something because we can't get into these clubs on Sunset Boulevard. They had essentially locked down. There had been some musical going on, El Grande, Coca-Cola going on at the Whiskey for years at that point. I mean, it just had moved in there. Nobody could get them out of there. And it was a musical and of some kind. I never even saw it, but it was just there forever. And the Starwood was only booking, kind of new signed acts. So they were like, you know, acts without much following yet, that the Hollywood record machine was, you know, spewing forward and spewing out on a continual basis. And there were, I don't know, there wasn't really any other club. I can't even remember. There were some others in existence, but again, they were either like kind of folk rock clubs or kind of that West Coast sound, but, you know, signed folkish acts that they'd. And so there was no place to play. And the only place that was a rock club on the strip was Gazzari's, a dance club. And Van Halen had, you know, was house band for that place. Were there all the time. So there was no place to play on the strip. And we needed to break into Hollywood and break it out. So we invented this event called Radio Free Hollywood, and we rented Troopers Hall, which is on La Brea, just off of Franklin, on La Brea, in Hollywood. It was an old, exactly that, Troopers for actors, a club, big club hall, house hall. And we booked that, and we had the motels, the dogs, we headlined it as we were doing it. And we were probably we were the best band. There's no question about that. But and a band called, I think, the Boys, B-O-Y-Z. I think there were four acts, and it was really cool. I mean, you know, Martha got her teeth into it, and you know, had some skits for her. She had two daughters already at the time, and we had the kids doing some skits, and I don't know. It was, and we publicized the hell out of it. Alan got press for us. I don't remember. I don't think we sold tickets in advance, but it was like there was this pent up need for something like that. And so, and plus all the all these bands had been playing these park gigs. So we had already followings, and we had the Backbone Man group behind us. And we had just put out a 45 prior to that, very recently to this, very recently previous to this. It was our first single. It was Break the Chain and Hit and Run Lover.
Right.
Hit and Run Lover was the first, was actually the more the A side. Did this gig, and it was tremendously well received. It was packed. I mean, there must have been 400 people in this hall of a, you know, I mean, it's just like a multi-purpose room sort of size hall, you know, so jam-packed with people. They loved it. It was great fun. There were writers there, fellow named Greg Shaw. He also had a fanzine called Bop.
Yep.
And he was actually the one who coined the term, it, as far as I understand it, far in my recollection, power pop, and in specific reference to our sound. he wrote, you know, the review of the show, and that became a useful kind of term. And of course, the rest is history in that regard, because it's broadly used now. Anyway, so it was a very successful thing. And what happened as a result of that was that these clubs started to book unsigned local bands that had, you know, because they said, well, shoot, they had, you know, 400 people at this show. Maybe we can, you know, they have following, so let's book them. So Starwood opened up. Eventually, the Rainbow opened up to us, but that was a little later. The Whiskey, and we played a number of shows there. Stuff started opening up all over the place. Clubs, all stripes, you know, and that spread out from there. I mean, we had played a lot of beer bars over the years as a popper with David Robinson and Steve T before any of those other later transformations occurred. But so we'd been playing a lot for a long time, but this really was the meat of it now, because we could do our shows, you know, do our original sets and, you know, two a night and, you know, feel like we were accomplishing something. Plus, we had a couple of singles out. Right on the heels of Radio Free Hollywood, we put out the Down on the Boulevard EP with Easy Action and I Need You by the Kinks. And that was also Backdoor Man funded label thing. They invented the Backdoor Man record label for our records, and they did some other ones too. Eventually, one of those guys spun off from that group, inherited some money or something, Greg Turner, and he and Alan then funded the completion of our first independent record on the Automatic record label, which we invented. There's nothing that wasn't approved of by Roger and I. Didn't matter what it was. we had a grip on things, and which was part of a problem, I think. But nonetheless, that was the condition of our existential condition. And that album came out at the end, and that took a couple more years. The end of 77 or the beginning of 78, I can't remember, when we finally got that album packaged up and out. Along the way, then, over the course of the next year and a half, from Radio Free Hollywood to, and I don't really think it was that long before that record came out. I think it was the end of 77, so just slightly more than a year. Joel started to get in trouble. I mentioned he had a drug problem. He was a junkie. I don't know where he is now. I don't know if he's alive or dead. The latter, I imagine. But he would get arrested, and so we'd have to find a drummer because he had gigs, you know. So one of the neighborhood drummers, Hollywood being the neighborhood, we learned of was Tim McGovern. And by this time also, we had discovered that Rick Bittner had left the band, but we had discovered that our roadie, Tim Henderson, was in fact quite an excellent bass player, because we had been reduced temporarily to a trio then again, Roger, myself, and Joel. And that great picture of us at the Whiskey in front of the slide screen of the image of Andy Warhol and some pop art stuff mixed in a collage was with Joel, Roger, and myself. We were just a power trio for quite a while. Steve T was gone. Robinson had left, right? Rick had bailed. So we were back down to a power trio. But when Joel would get, and meanwhile, we're still doing, you know, these seasonal fraternity party brawls. And we would occasionally need a drummer. So we'd call McGovern, and it was always great fun playing with him. He was a tremendous drummer. He played all the drums on the Go album, all the songs, drums, and all the tracks on the Go album. And, it was just great fun to play with as a drummer. And we had discovered that Henderson was we had been up in San Francisco as the trio, and Henderson said, well, I play bass, you know, I know the song Hit and Run Lover. David, why don't you go out and be just a front man or something? I don't know how the idea evolved. But anyway, he played bass on Hit and Run Lover, and I just did front man lead singer thing for a couple of songs at Mabuhay Gardens up in Frisco. I think it was the first time we did that. And so he kind of became the bass player, and I went back to playing guitar. And then gradually, as things evolved and McGovern would periodically appear on our records, as we finished up that first album, he played, I think, I don't know, 3-4 tracks on. We dumped about 4 tracks out of the 10 or 11 songs we were going to put out on that first record. And we did some new ones with McGovern on drums because Joel was incapacitated or something. I don't know. And McGovern was a better drummer. I said, look, we want you to do this. And so he also added guitars on it. And so he became a member of the band along with Henderson at the same time. So we went from a 3-piece to a 5-piece virtually overnight with the advent and release of the Pop album on the Automatic label. So now we're a 5-piece. And we're McGovern was interesting. Joel was still playing, appearing with us as drummer when we could keep him out of jail. So, but McGovern was playing guitar. He said, look, I want to play guitar. I don't really want to be a drummer. I'm a guitar player. And he had this kind of psycho funkish style, Hendrix-y kind of playing, but it was incredibly musical. He's a very musical man. I mean, you know, and I was, you know, fascinated by his musicianship, right? And so, you know, he sang a little bit. And so, you know, it's an interesting additional guitar thing and default drummer and, you know, but a pain in the ass, you know, but nonetheless, okay, you know, do what you have to do, you know, sort of firmly the ends justified the means at that point. We'd been doing this for a while and we wanted to go somewhere with it finally, you know. So as the 5-piece, we appeared and we started getting the good, you know, we were getting good gigs and around the whole Southland at that point, up, you know, been to San Francisco a couple of times, and Arizona, I don't know, someplace in Arizona, but so we were getting around, and we finally got signed then later in the fall of 78. The album had been out for 9 months or something like that, and because it came out right at the end of 77, I think, kind of a holiday thing. In September of 78, we got signed from playing a club down in Orange County someplace. Bud Scapa from Arista Records. We'd been trolling Arista for a while, Alan had, because he had worked with Clive Davis years earlier at Columbia. So, and we hadn't really gotten any place with them, but Bud Scapa fell in love with the band when he saw us and said, I'm going to get you guys signed to Arista, which he did promptly. And so it was like big excitement. And within like, I don't know, 2 weeks, we had this approval of a deal with Arista in the fall of 78. The evolution of the music had gone through numerous phases. Our best power pop stuff really was done with Robinson. And of course, you know, there's songs like Easy Action, which unfortunately the vocal on which was miserably undermixed, but I've remastered that and tried to evoke a little more of that in a mastering context. But, Easy Action, I mean, I said Boulevard, You Oughta Know, Walk in the Rain.
I walk in the rain. Pantheon podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house, and my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have, but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out, because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once. New quick charge function, three customizable sound styles, plus awareness mode. Available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So, what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
You know, it was kind of the guy from the producer that did Boomtown Rats loved Leather and Lace. And we met with him as producer when we got signed with Aristo, we were shopping producers. He just was dying to produce the band, but he wanted that kind of stuff, which was not exactly Roger's wheelhouse, but I liked it. I wrote it, you know, and thought it was, I really liked it. I thought it was a great track. So up to that point, there had been a fair amount of power pop stuff, some of which never emerged. There's a great song that Roger wrote called He's a Little Wild that never appeared. Nobody's Toy, of course, was in that genre somewhat, although much more of that sort of monolith, more of a hard-driving, dynamically monolithic track that Roger liked. They were of an ilk. Nobody's Toy and He's a Little Wild, which nobody's ever heard, which is a great track. What we did with Robinson in the early days of that production deal with George Tobin and Alan Rindy before Robinson left. So that was really the power popish stuff, you know, even Hit and Run Lover, you know, I think could fall into that category. But as we moved in then to the deal with Arista, which took a while to actually manifest, we didn't get started on that until the spring of 79. That's how long it took us to get them off their asses and for us to select a producer, because all the producers we were interested in had other projects that they had lined up before they could get to us. And in contradistinction to the Knack, who had that one great song and were knocking it down at the Troubadour. Oh, the Troubadour, that's another club that opened up because they were just doing, you know, country folk stuff, Dr. John, the Night Trip. But they started playing and doing rock stuff there, and the Knack really was knocking them down there at the Troubadour. with that song, and they got signed to Capitol well after we were signed. Motels, well after we were signed. 2020, well after we were signed. But in that year, 79, by the time we got our shit together, these other bands were right there at our shoulders, you know, in terms of who was, you know, advancing the power pop cause in L.A. at that time. And they enacted their record in, I don't know, a month or something like that. It was nuts. They just went there and just, like the way the Beatles recorded their first record, right? Just in and out, get it out in a month, you know, kind of just out, just very succinctly. We were, you know, caught up in the elaboration of our three guitars, and we finally chose Earl Menke, who Roger and I had been in association with or knew of since the Modern Lovers. In fact, I met David Robinson, not at the Modern Lovers gig, but he had called us from the Whiskey at some point when Sparks were playing there, right after Modern Lovers finished their record, before he went back to Boston, only to return after the holidays. That's when we met Earl Menke, was in 73. Mm-hmm. And Roger and I had talked to him at the end of the year, 73, or the 74. He had just left Sparks, had divorced. We stayed in touch with him, and we liked him. He was tremendously helpful and technically very, you know, advisorly. He had lots of good ideas and technical stuff for our recordings, et cetera, et cetera. And because he was an engineer, he was also at the time had been working with Beach Boys as an engineer. So we liked Earl, we knew his abilities, so we worked with him because he was available. Finally, we had to choose, and we thought, well, we have a dialogue. It's not going to be somebody coming in with an imprimatur to say, this is where we're going to make your record. You know, and we have to, you know, suck it up and go along with it. You know, we thought there was more of a peer level thing there. So we went with Earl, but we were, you know, delayed in our elaboration with our three guitars, working things out at Earl's home studio before we went back into Sound City and to lay down the final tracks, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. It took us a month of Sundays. We ended up coming out at the same time after, very, very shortly after, like the Motels had came out just before us. The Knack had been out for a couple of months. 2020 came out concurrent with us. You know, so we were suddenly in almost lost in the shuffle, you know, in the dust, you know, of what was occurring in LA at that time. So, and plus we had endured, as you well know, from the point of immediately after Radio Free Hollywood in 76, which was early 76, shortly thereafter, within a couple of months or a month or so, came the advent of, guess who, the Sex Pistols, which sent everyone to their closets and their four tracks to slightly reinvent themselves in order to not be left in the dust from that catastrophe, you know, catastrophic occurrence in the industry, really. I mean, you know, the punk thing. So we had already kind of had to, and I say had to, but by the natural flow of things, evolved and pushed ourselves a little bit into this category of, quote, new wave. So the power pop thing, although there were still great power pop songs on the Go album, namely She Really Means That Much to Me, even Waiting for the Night. Those two songs together on that side of the record, Waiting for the Night, Indigo, I mean, remain one of my favorite combinations of songs on any album. I love listening to those two together. So there was still that aspect of our music, but we were kind of, you know, working very hard to synthesize three guitars into an orchestral way of working, carving out specific areas of sonic frequency within the mix of a track, of a song, to gain clarity and meaning and intricacy. Interest of the three guitars working together. So it became a much more elaborate process and a very much slower process by virtue of working with a very meticulous person in Earl Mankey. I mean, he's a very, very meticulous guy. So there were good things and bad things, you know, that went into that. And ultimately, I think not only did we suffer in the sense of pacing of the release of the record amidst those who followed us and being signed. We were the first band to be signed out of that LA milieu at the time and ended up just being amongst them in the final analysis. But also the record, I think, was overthought in the final analysis, and we lost the rawness that we had on the best parts of the previous independent record, the pop album. So I don't ever think, even although it was a, quote, real record with a real label, it was really as potent as the previous record was. Brian, this is after years of reflection on this, occasionally revisiting those records and listening to them. It was a hard admission for me to come to that I think that kind of was the case. Somehow overthinking it tamped it down a bit. And then certainly, I mean, don't even talk to me about the Rhino record. That was at the end of things, you know. And this is really, really breaks my heart. The best pop songs that the pop was ever responsible for, to my mind, was Broken Pieces. And we were rushed in the studio to finish that, to do an album for Rhino, because we'd lost the Arista deal. McGovern was gone. We had reformed with a new drummer, of course, Robert Williams, who we picked up after the Arista record was done, because Noel was by that time in prison. Not just jail, but in prison. Hence McGovern doing all the drumming. That happened immediately after we signed with Arista, practically. Joel lit fire to his apartment with his girlfriend sleeping there, and, you know, was arrested for arson and endangerment, whatever you call it, criminal endangerment. So he was in jail at that point, prison. And but eventually when McGovern left, which is another long story that I'm not going to, involving Martha and the motels, and McGovern just being sort of a rat bastard in the final analysis duo. And I speak of him in the kindest terms, but I mean, I really did like him. I admire his music, his musicianship. To this day, kind of like him, although he's a scoundrel, you know, but, or was to us at that time. I've heard he's since, you know, cleaned up his act, but, you know, who knows? I hear about him through Robert Williams, the Pops drummer, one of the late stage pop drummers, and who I have a very good relationship and admire, and whose drumming I admire quite a bit. Anyway, so he's still friends with McGovern, as is Terry Henderson, Tim Henderson's wife. She's in touch with him a lot. So he's lurking about somewhere up in Seattle. But so it was a long and checkered story. But in the end, when we were doing the Hearts and Knives album for Rhino, we had lost our Arista deal because of all these machinations and failings of Arista's part and our part and the firing of Alan, which I will never... never be at peace with now, especially regret now that he's passed on. And I was dead against it, but was outvoted. And of course, now we're on our own. We are unchaperoned. Yeah. We are in a dead deal with Arista, soon to have to pry ourselves free from it. That by the end of 79 was... pretty much right around the end of the year, right after McGovern left, beginning of 80, was evident we had to get out of that deal because they were holding us hostage, and we started to submit demos to them. Well, we didn't actually know that we had to get out of it yet. By May, when we were going to Europe for a little stint, Jerry Heller agency, Jerry Heller was trying to get us out of the deal with Arista because they would not... or move us forward in our deal, trying to get Clive to move forward with letting, if in fact they were demanding this, which the second it was a recall in the deal, that they could require a second album for no additional advance other than our union payments, union wages, if they decided to. That was, of course, most of these did, but we couldn't get to move ahead on it. Had them come and listen to us a couple of times, and I said, "Well, we don't really hear the song yet. There was some good stuff there." Well, we're not hearing it. Blah blah blah. So we came back to the States, and now we felt that's it. We've just got to get out of this deal, which Buziak then pried us out of thinking that he could get us re-signed. Well, by the end of the year, we still were not re-signed. Desperate to get another record out before we lost all any and all momentum that we might still have been retaining, we approached Rhino, Harold Bronson, a close friend of Alan's, with Alan's help, I think, to let us do a record for them, which they paid, get this, $3,600. Well, of course, all we could do is a short thing, sort of this mini LP, six songs, and it was rushed and tragically underproduced, sounding empty and thin in the giant cavernous reality that is Sound City Studios, or was. And, you know, with the engineer who had worked with Earl Mankey on the Go Elf and us, and me being in a fairly exhausted state of psychic metaphysical distress, I guess you could say, at that stage. And yet two more drummers down the line from Robert Williams, the guy who we had hired at the release of the Go album. So now the drummer on that record being David Hoscott. So, you know, it was just a hopelessly poorly produced record. That was the story. So, but my favorite all-time pop song, and maybe it's because it was so tragically under-realized on that record, was Broken Pieces. And it's so simple. It just needed a guitar break, and it's just you play the guitar solo after the second chorus, back into a pre-chorus guitar solo, back into the chorus, a couple of choruses, and out, you know. And it would have made it makes all the difference to that song. I mean, it's like this incredibly beautiful, full thing that is, you know, it just needed that one little extra thought that we couldn't give it for some reason. Didn't give it, you know, under duress of stress of time and lack of money, you know.
Shows no sign of life, a hope in time will cry alone this time. I'm in pieces, broken pieces, I'm in pieces of.
That came out in March or something, like April or March of 81. And by May or June, I had sort of, you know, said, like, I got to leave. I can't do this anymore. So Our last gig was July 4th, I think, 81, at a theater on Wilshire somewhere. It was a real, let me just say this about all this, that it was a real gift to have been a part of that, regardless of how the chips fell out, you know, and what we didn't achieve that we wanted to achieve, might have achieved, should have achieved, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it was a gift to have been part of that and to have worked with some of the, known those people, those guys, worked with a lot of them, you know.
Yeah.
It was a great blessing in my life.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's fantasypoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. Fantasypoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.